23. The sunlight followed them inside, casting a long, glowing strip down the tiled floor. Ravi closed the door, and they walked slowly down the hall. Pip couldn't help but tiptoe, even though she knew no one was home. She'd seen this house many times before, photographed at different angles with police swarming outside. But that was the outside. All she'd ever seen of the inside were snatches from when the front door was open and captured by a press photographer. The border between outside and in felt significant here. She could tell Ravi felt it, too, by the way he held his breath. There was a heaviness to the air, secrets captured in the silence, floating around like invisible motes of dust. Pip didn't even want to think too loudly in case she disturbed it. This quiet place, where Andy Bell was last seen alive, when she was only a few months older than Pip. The house itself, part of the mystery. They moved toward the stairs, glancing into the plush living room on the right and the huge vintage-style kitchen on the left, fitted with robin's egg blue cabinets and a large wood-top island. And then they heard it, a small thump upstairs. Pip froze. Ravi grabbed her gloved hand with his. Another thump, closer this time, just above their heads. Pip looked back at the door. Could they make it out in time? The thumps became a sound of frantic jingling, and a black cat appeared at the top of the stairs. Holy crap, Ravi said, dropping his shoulders and Pip's hand, the relief rippling off him. Pip let out a hollow, anxious laugh, her hands starting to sweat inside the rubber. The cat leaped down the stairs, stopping halfway to meow in their direction. Hi, cat, she whispered as it padded down the rest of the stairs and slinked over to her. It rubbed its face on her shins, curling in and out between her legs. Pip, I really don't like cats, Ravi said, recoiling as the cat started to press its head into his ankles. Pip patted the cat lightly with her rubber-gloved hand, and it started to purr. Come on, she said to Ravi. Leaving the cat behind, Pip headed up the stairs. Ravi followed, and the cat meowed and raced after them, darting between his legs. Pip! Ravi trailed off anxiously as he tried not to step on it. Pip shooed the cat, and it trotted back downstairs into the kitchen. I wasn't scared, he added unconvincingly. Sure. Gloved hand on the banister, she climbed to the top, almost knocking off a notebook and a USB stick that were balanced precariously on the railing. Strange place to leave them. Upstairs, Pip studied the doors that opened onto the landing. In the back bedroom on the right, the floral bedspread was ruffled and slept in, paired socks on the chair in the corner. The bedroom at the front had a dressing gown strewn on the floor and a glass of water on a bedside table. Neither could be Andy's. Ravi tapped Pip gently on the arm and pointed. There was only one door up here that was closed. They crossed over to it, and Pip grasped the gold handle to push it open. It was immediately obvious this was her room. Everything felt staged and stagnant. Though it had all the props of a teenage girl's bedroom, pinned up photos of Andy with Emma and Chloe at the winter carnival, a small framed picture of her and Sal, his arm round her waist and her eyes glittering. An old brown teddy tucked into the bed, an overflowing makeup case on the desk. The room didn't feel quite real. A place entombed in 5 years of grief. Pip stepped onto the plush cream carpet. Her eyes scanned the room, from the lilac walls to the white wooden furniture, everything clean and polished, the carpet showing recent vacuum tracks. Dawn Bell must still clean her dead daughter's room, preserving it as it was when Andy left it for the final time. She didn't have her daughter, but she still had the place where she'd slept, where she'd woken, where she'd dressed, where she'd screamed and shouted and slammed the door, where her mom had whispered goodnight and turned off the light. Or so Pip imagined, reanimating the empty room with the life that might have been lived here. Pip looked back at Ravi, and by the expression on his face, she knew there was a room just like this in the Singh's house. And though Pip had come to feel like she knew Andy, the one buried under all those secrets, this bedroom made Andy a real person to her for the first time. As she and Ravi approached the wardrobe, Pip silently promised the room that she would find the truth, not just for Sal, but for Andy, too. The truth that could very well be hidden right here. "Ready?" Ravi whispered. She nodded, and he opened the wardrobe. Inside was a rack bulging with dresses and tops, no room to part even an inch of space between the clothes. Struggling with the rubber gloves, Pip pulled her phone out of her jeans pocket and turned on the flashlight. She got down on her knees with Ravi beside her, and they crawled under the garments, lighting up the old floorboards inside. They started prodding the slats, tracing their fingers around the shape of them, trying to pry up their corners. Ravi pushed down one corner at the back, and the other side of the floorboard kicked up. Pip shuffled forward to pull it out of the way, and then they leaned over to look inside the dark gap below. "No." She moved the light down inside the small space to be absolutely sure, pivoting the light into each corner. It revealed only layers of dust, disturbed now by their breath. No phone, no cash, no drug stash, nothing. "It's not here," Ravi said. The disappointment was a physical sensation tearing through Pip's stomach. "I really thought it would be here," he said. Pip had too. The burner phone was supposed to be here, supposed to reveal the killer's name, and then the police would do the rest. Pip was supposed to be safe from unknown. But it wasn't here. She slid the floorboard back in place and inched backward out of the wardrobe after Ravi, her hair getting tangled in the zipper of a long dress. "Where could the burner phone be then?" Ravi asked. "Maybe Andy had it on her when she died," Pip said, "and now it's buried with her or otherwise destroyed by the killer." "Or," Ravi said, studying the items on Andy's desk, "someone knew where it was hidden, and they took it after she went missing, knowing it would lead the police to them if it was found."
"Or that," Pip agreed, "but that doesn't help us now."
She joined Ravi at the desk. On top of the makeup case was a paddle hairbrush with long blonde hairs still wound around the bristles. Beside it, a Fairview High School academic planner for the year 2013-2014, almost identical to the one Pip had for this year. Andy had decorated the title page with doodled hearts and stars and small printouts of supermodels. She flipped through some of the pages. The days were filled with scribbled homework assignments and test dates. November and December had various college open house days listed. The week before Christmas, Andy had a note to herself, "Maybe get Sal a Christmas present." Dates and locations of calamity parties, people's birthdays, and strangely, random letters with times scribbled in next to them. "Hey," she held it up to show Ravi. "Look at these weird initials all over the place. What do you think they mean?" Ravi stared for a moment, resting his jaw in his gardening gloved hand.
"Do you remember that thing Howie Bowers said to us? That he'd told Andy to use codes instead of names?"
"Maybe these are her codes," Pip said, tracing her rubber finger over the random letters. "We should document these." She laid the planner down and pulled out her phone again. Ravi helped her tug one of her gloves off, and she opened the camera.
Ravi skipped the pages back to February 2014, and Pip took pictures of each page spread until that week in April, just after spring break. The last thing Andy had written on that Friday was, "Start French revision notes soon." "Okay," Pip said, pocketing her phone and slipping the glove back on. The front door slammed below them. Ravi's head snapped around, terror pooling in the pupils of his eyes. Pip dropped the planner back in its place and nodded toward the wardrobe. "Get back in," she whispered. She opened the doors and crawled inside, looking back for Ravi. He was on his knees just outside. Pip shuffled aside to give him space to crawl in, but Ravi wasn't moving. Why wasn't he moving? Pip reached forward and grabbed him, pulling him into her against the back wall, and Ravi snapped back to life. He grasped the wardrobe doors and shut them inside. Sharp-heeled steps in the hallway. Was it Andy's mom, back from work already?
"Hello, Monty," a voice carried through the house.
It was Becca. Ravi was shaking beside her. She moved closer and took his hand, the rubber gloves squeaking as she held on. They heard Becca on the stairs then, louder with each step, the jingling collar of the cat behind her.
"Ah, that's where I left them," she said, footsteps pausing on the landing.
Pip squeezed Ravi's hand, his face just a few inches away. She hoped he knew she would take the fall if she could.
"Monty, have you been in here?"
Becca's voice drew nearer. Ravi closed his eyes.
"You know you're not supposed to go in this room."
Pip buried her face into his shoulder. Becca was in the room with them now. They could hear her breathing, hear the clicking of her bones as she moved. More steps stifled by the thick carpet. And then the sound of Andy's bedroom door closing.
"Bye, Monty."
Becca's words were muffled now on the other side of the door. Ravi opened his eyes slowly, squeezing Pip's hand back, his panicked breaths rippling through her hair. The front door slammed again. Pippa Fitz Amobi. October 7th, 2019. Capstone Project Log, Entry 25. I guess that's what they mean by a close call. Ravi still wasn't quite himself by the time he had to leave for work, and the burner phone wasn't even there. But the break-in might not have been for nothing. I emailed the photos of Andy's planner to myself so I could see them bigger on my laptop screen. I've gone through each one dozens of times, and I think there are some things to pick up on here. This is the week after spring break, the week Andy disappeared. There's a lot to look at on this page alone, starting with the Fat Da Silva 0, Andy 3 scorecard comment. This was just after Andy posted the nude video of Nat online, and I know from Nat that she only returned to school on Wednesday, April 16th, and Andy called her a slut in the corridor, prompting the death threat stuffed in Andy's locker. But judging this comment at face value, it seems Andy was gloating over three victories she'd had over Nat in her twisted games. If the topless video was one of these goals, was blackmailing Nat to drop out of the crucible another? Then what was the third thing Andy did to Nat Da Silva? Could that have been what made Nat snap and turned her into a killer? Another significant entry on that page is on Wednesday, April 16th. T.S. at 7:30. If Ravi is right and Andy was writing things down in code, I think I've cracked this one. It's so simple. T.S. equals train station, as in the train station parking lot. I think Andy was reminding herself that she had a meeting with Howie at the station that evening. I know that she did, in fact, meet Howie that evening, because Sal wrote Howie's license plate number in his phone at 7:42 p.m. on the very same Wednesday.
There are many more instances of TS with an accompanying time in the photos we took. I think I can confidently say that these refer to Andy's drug trades with Howie, and that she was following Howie's instructions to use codes to keep her activities secret from prying eyes. Having them in her planner was the perfect memory prompt. There are other initialized entries with times written in the planner. During this mid-March week, Andy wrote on Thursday the 13th, IV at 8. This one I'm stumped on. If it follows the same code pattern, then IV equals IV. If, like TS, IV refers to a place, I have no idea what it is. There's nowhere in Fairview I can think of with those initials. Or could IV refer to somebody's name? It appears only 3 times in the pages we photographed. There's a similar entry that appears much more frequently. HH at 6. On this March 15th entry, Calam presumably means calamity party. So maybe HH actually just means Howie's house, and Andy was picking up drugs to take to the party. An earlier spread in March caught my eye, too. The numbers scrawled in and scribbled out above Thursday, March 6th, are a phone number. 10 digits, starting with 475, an area code for Connecticut, it has to be. But why would Andy write a cell phone number in her planner? Why not enter it straight into her phone? Unless this number wasn't meant for her actual phone. Maybe she wrote it down because her burner phone wasn't on her at the time, and that's where she wanted this number to go. Could this be secret older guy's number? Or maybe a new phone number for Howie? Or a new client wanting to buy from her? After she entered it into her second phone, she must have scribbled over it to hide her tracks. I've been staring at the scribble for a good half hour. It looks to me like the first 8 digits are 4755551. It's possible that last number is a 7 instead, but I'm fairly certain it's a 1. For the final 2 digits, it gets tricky because they're scribbled out so thoroughly. The second final digit looks like a 7 or a 9 or a 1, the way it seems to have a leg and a hooked line at the top. And the final number looks like it has a curve, so either a 6, a 0, or an 8. This leaves us with 9 possible combinations. 475-555-0196. 475-555-0176. 475-555-0116. 475-555-0190. 475-555-0170. 475-555-0110. 475-555-0198. 475-555-0178. 475-555-0118. I've tried calling the first column. I got the same robotic response to each call. I'm sorry, the number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please hang up and try again. In the second column, I got a no longer in service, a generic phone provider voicemail, and an elderly woman up in New Haven. The last column racked up 1 not recognized, 1 no longer in service, and another generic voicemail. Chasing this phone number is another dud. I can hardly make out those last 2 digits, and the number is over 5 years old now and probably out of use. I'll keep trying the ones that went to generic voicemails, just in case anything comes of it, but I really need to get going with my application. Should I write about that time I got lost at the zoo? Was that a formative experience?
My father dying when I was too young to remember him. Gah, 650 words is far too many for someone who doesn't know who they are. Persons of interest: Jason Bell, in bold, Naomi Ward, secret older guy, Nat Da Silva, Daniel Da Silva, Max Hastings, Howie Bowers. Pippa Fitz Amobi, October 9th, 2019. Capstone Project Log, Entry 26. No, I haven't got any further with my personal essay. I wrote 300 crappy words yesterday and deleted them right after. And now I'm finding myself dragged back into the world of Andy Bell, clicking on my Capstone Project document when I should be opening a blank page. But thinking about a dead girl is so much easier than thinking about myself. I've read over Andy's planner so many times that I can almost recite her February to April schedule by heart. One thing is abundantly clear. Andy Bell was a homework procrastinator. Two other things are quite clear, leaning on assumption. T.S. refers to Andy's drug deal meetings with Howie at the station parking lot, and H.H. refers to those at his house. I still haven't managed to work out IV at all. It appears only three times in total, on Thursday, March 13th at 8, Friday, March 21st at 9, and Thursday, March 27th at 9. Unlike TS's or HH's, which jump around at all different times, IV is once at 8 and twice at 9. Ravi's been working on this too. He just sent me an email with a list of possible people or places IV could refer to. He's spread the search outside Fairview, looking into neighboring towns as well. I should have thought of that. His list: Imperial Vault Nightclub in Stamford, Ivy House Inn in Westport, Ida Vaughn, aged 90, lives in Wilton, The Four Cafe in New Canaan, IV equals 4 in Roman numerals. Imperial Vault's website says that the club was opened in 2012. From its location on the map, it looks like it's just in the middle of nowhere, a concrete slab nightclub and parking lot amid a mass of green grass pixels. It holds regular events like Ladies' Night, and the club is owned by a man named Rob Hewitt. I guess it's possible Andy was going there to sell drugs. We could go look into it, ask to speak to the owner. The Ivy House Inn doesn't have its own website, but it has a page on TripAdvisor with only 2.5 stars. It's a small, family-run B&B with 4 available rooms, right by Westport Station. From the few pictures on the site, it looks quaint and cozy, but it's near a loud, busy road, according to Carmel 672's review, and Trevor 59 wasn't happy with them at all. They double-booked his room. T9 Jones said the host was lovely, but that the bathroom was tired and filthy, with dirt tracked all around the tub. She's posted some pictures to bolster her point. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God! I've been saying that out loud for at least 30 seconds, but it's not enough. Oh my God! And why won't Ravi pick up his damn phone? That last review includes 2 close-up pictures of the tub at different angles, and then a long shot of the entire bathroom. Beside the bath is a huge, full-length mirror on the wall. We can see the reviewer and the flash of her phone reflected in it. We can see the rest of the bathroom, too, from its cream ceiling with circle spotlights down to its tiled floor. A red and white tiled floor. I'm almost certain it's the very same tiled floor from the printed photo that was pinned up behind the Reservoir Dogs poster in Max Hastings' bedroom. Andy, naked, except for a pair of black underwear, pouting at a mirror. This mirror in the Ivy House Inn, Westport. If I'm right, then Andy went to that bed and breakfast at least 3 times in the span of 3 weeks. Who was she there to meet? Max? Secret older guy? Looks like I'm going to Westport after school tomorrow.